This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 62 was recorded May 11th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Hoisington chief economist Dr. Lacey Hunt will be joining me as this week's featured interview guest. The primary subject of discussion will be the 35-year bond bull market and why Dr. Hunt thinks it's anything but over. Now, our programming strategy is to bring you a series of three interviews with economists who are all highly respected, but who have contrasting views on the economy and financial markets. Last week, we featured Professor Steve Keen. This week, we've got Dr. Lacey Hunt. And be sure to tune in next week, because we have another rock star of economics book to complete the three-part series. Dr. Hunt sent us an outstanding book of graphs and charts to support today's interview, and I highly recommend that you download them before listening, as we'll be referring to them throughout the interview. Registered users at macrovoices.com already received the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you haven't registered yet, you can find instructions to register your free account and get the download right next to Dr. Hunt's photo on our homepage at www.macrovoices.com.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Now, before we dive into today's market wrap, I just wanted to mention that we taped this show a couple hours earlier than usual, so our commentary won't include anything that's happened in the markets after 1:30 p.m. on Thursday. So now, Eric, that S&P 500 has had nothing but volatility over the last few days, rejecting at 2,400 numerous times, but no real big sell-off just yet. What's your feeling about the S&P 500 here?
I'm actually surprised that it hasn't broken out above 2,400, honestly. And no, my view has not changed. I still think that the market is way overvalued. But, you know, I don't think that we're at the point of that bullish euphoria being exhausted yet. And as much as it doesn't make sense to me, I was kind of thinking that we'd get through it. You're right, though. You know, the more times that the market rejects the same level, the theory is that that means it's harder to get through, that resistance is firming at 2,400. So maybe that's the top. I kind of doubt it. I think we're probably headed higher before this thing is over. And, you know, I think about at this level about puts. And the reason I see puts as longer protection being attractive is not because I think the high number is in and we've reached the peak of the market. But boy, the VIX trading on a 9 handle, Patrick, you couldn't ask for cheaper volatility. The thing, though, is that if I were buying puts, it wouldn't be near-dated puts. It would be longer-dated, at least out to the end of this year, if not to, you know, a year from now, say June of 2018. Now, you're paying more for volatility there because there's so much contango in the VIX futures strip. So, I don't know. I'm starting to think about accumulating puts as a little bit of a lottery ticket trade that I think eventually we're going to see a very big move to the downside coming in the next year. But are we there yet? It doesn't feel like it to me.
All right. Well, let's take a look at that U.S. dollar index. And it's really interesting because to me, the dollar index is not telling the full story. We see some pretty big breakdowns in a lot of currencies against the U.S. dollar. But because the dollar index is weighted so much against the euro really has been holding up, keeping that dollar index suppressed. I mean, it's right now around the 99.5 level. What's your feeling about the dollar index here?
Well, at least we are seeing some strength back up. Some technicians I'm following are saying that there's a key technical level around 99 spot, 25, 29, something like that. The longer we stay above that, the better it looks. I'm still on the sidelines, though. I think, as you say, the dollar index is very heavily weighted to the euro, and the euro is in so much, there's just so much going on in Europe, even after the resolution of the French elections. You know, the situation is not stabilized there. So is the euro going to continue to appreciate? Is that going to hold the dollar down? You know, I don't know. I continue to feel the same way that I have about the dollar, which is I'm still bullish structurally in the longer term. I'm happy to be sitting out a couple of dances here, maybe get better location on getting into this trade a little bit lower into the low 90s or something if we get another test down there. For now, I'm happy to sit in the sidelines.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because this is where I want to hear your opinion for sure. I mean, obviously, that selling really intensified, and really, we saw that big capitulation coming down to the $44 level on oil, and then we got this bounce. What's your thinking here on oil?
Well, you sure got that one right, Patrick. You know, I was kidding last week when I said we might see that 44 handle before the day was over. And, of course, before the night was over, we saw a 43 handle. 43.76 was the low print last Thursday night after we had taped the show. And, you know, we started seeing a bounce back above that. At first, it was looking awfully lot like it was going to be a dead cat bounce and roll back over and head back down. But, of course, the big catalyst was inventory. We had a huge bullish surprise with crude drawing down a massive 5.2 million barrels, Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 438,000 barrels, gasoline, which was API, the American Petroleum Institute, expected to be a build. That turned out to be a draw of 150,000 barrels, a small draw, but a draw just the same. Distillates drawing down 1.6 million barrels. Drawdowns across the board, Patrick, and that, of course, was very bullish for crude oil. We started to move rapidly higher from there, but, you know, a 200-day moving average is still a really big deal, and that's still way up there at 49, just over 49, I think 49 spot 11 is what I'm showing on my chart today. So this inventory-driven rally, it seems to me, is likely to probably either get close to, if not retest that. A very common phenomenon, as you know, in technical analysis, is when you take out a key support level. Sometimes you go back and rally up just enough to touch it one more time, give you a chance to sell that level before it turns over and goes back down again. So it feels to me like probably, if I had to guess what was going to happen next, we'll see this rally that's been driven by inventory continue into early next week, maybe retest that 49 level where the 200-day moving average is, and, you know, see what happens with inventory. If we had another massive drawdown, well, that's changing fundamentals. Anything could happen. I think what's more likely is that that really big drawdown was exacerbated by some hiccups in the Houston Ship Channel. Some ships not getting into port, that takes a dent in the amount of imported oil, and that increases the size of the apparent drawdown. So I think that it's possible that we'll get a retest. I'll be surprised if we break out above the 200-day moving average. So I continue to take a bearish view. But as I said last week, Patrick, when we were at 55, it was really easy to call what was going to happen next. I knew we were headed down to 45. Are we headed to 35 next, or is this 45-ish level going to kind of be it? I don't know. I'm watching carefully. I think that the next few weeks of inventory are going to tell us a lot. And I also think that we're probably getting to a point now where this is going to be a story that is as much about open interest, where it's going to be important to look at the commitment of traders reports and say, okay, we got the froth out of the market where there was just a ridiculous amount of speculative long interest. We're back down to just a lot of speculative long interest. Is it going to continue to unwind? Are we going to see a full unwind of that the way we did in 2014 and 15, which eventually ended in that low print of $26? Are we just going to come back into the middle of the range? I'm going to be watching the open interest and inventory very carefully, and I won't be surprised if after maybe retesting that 200-day level, maybe not, if we end up still lower from here, below that 43.76 low print. But I'm not nearly as confident in that view as I was when I said at 55 we were headed for 45.
Well, Eric, you know, if I can add a technical observation, you know, whenever oil sells to that kind of velocity to the downside, it is always common to see a reactionary move. And there's traders will use Fibonacci's and all sorts of things to measure retracements. But to me, if I was to just summarize it for our listeners, I think the longer oil stays below the $50 level on any sustained basis, the more likely there's another leg lower coming in oil. I think the only way the bulls can really put this together is get it back up into the 50s in order to take it out of that danger zone. Nonetheless, I want to move on to gold here. And what's surprising is obviously we had that little bit of a breakdown in gold the other week, but really gold's been very quiet. Not much going on there. It's really been range bound over the last few days in this kind of pivoting off this 1220 handle. What's your feeling on gold here?
Well, you know, I said a couple of months ago in this program when we were flirting with 1300 or whatever the high print was, I think a pullback towards 1220 is coming. I'll think about buying it then. Well, I thought about it, but I didn't buy it. And, you know, we saw a low of 1214 this week. I think we're probably headed lower from here. If you look at a really long-term chart, if you draw a trend line that goes from that high in 2011, the all-time high, through the next major high a couple years later, this last high that we just hit appears to test that same trend trend line. And if you project that down, you can actually come up with a target of 890, 890 on gold. Now, that doesn't mean that's going to happen. But I look at commodities across the board, Patrick, and look at what's going on with iron ore. Look at what's going on with copper. We're seeing this Trump reflation commodity trade, and particularly with what's going on in China, it's putting a lot of deflationary pressure on. And I think that commodities in general look very weak here. So I'm going to sit back and watch and see what happens. Maybe I'm missing it again. I regretted not buying gold when I thought about buying it at 1125. And well, at least it's less than $100 left to go before we get back below that.
I know there's macro guys like Raoul Paul that are long the U.S. dollar and long gold as a pair trading. But really, the natural intermarket relationship is that U.S. dollar influences gold and these commodities. And I think that most people have really now gone neutral on that U.S. dollar index. So I think the biggest headwind for gold could be a big U.S. dollar breakout. You know, and if we have a big U.S. dollar rally, maybe that really does open up some more ominous declines in gold. But I don't want to make that kind of a prediction, but that's certainly one of the catalysts that could be the driver. Anyway, let's have a look at treasury bonds and those 10-year yields, once again hovering now at this 240 level. What's your feeling here on treasury?
I think as far as the long-term outlook on treasuries, let's save that for the interview with Dr. Hunt, because he's obviously going to have a lot to say about that. As far as where we are right now, high two spot 30s kind of hovering around here. I still think lower yields are coming. I was in touch with Juliet DeClercq this week. I asked her if she's still advising her clients to stay long 10-year treasuries. She said, yes, she is. So I don't think this is over yet, Patrick. And, you know, if we listen to what Dr. Hunt has to say, his view is that it's far from over. So we'll save the rest for the interview.
Great market insights, Eric. Dr. Lacey Hunt from Hoisington Investment Management is our guest this week. Eric's interview with Dr. Hunt is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Dr. Lacey Hunt, Chief Economist for the Wasatch Hoisington Treasury Bond Fund. Dr. Hunt, I'm so excited to get you on the program because we've had so many notable people calling for the end of the 35-year secular bull market in bonds. And a lot of guests we've had in this program haven't really wanted to take sides on this issue. I think you're not going to have that problem because you have a very strong view. So is the secular bull market in bonds really over? And if not, why not? And particularly, I know in the slide deck that you sent us, there's an excellent slide showing the velocity of money that's been in free fall, not just since the great financial crisis, but really since the late 90s. So how does that play into this story? And how does it relate to your expectations for the continuance of this bond bull market?
My view is that the secular low in long treasury bonds is not at hand. Doesn't mean that rates cannot go up. They have gone up quite a number of times since 1990 when this bull run started, but they're not going to be able to stay up. The economy is too fundamentally weak. The main consideration for believing that the trough is not at hand is that nominal GDP growth and also the inflation rate is not yet at its secular low. There have been many transitory swings. There will continue to be transitory swings. But the critical factors that determine a nominal GDP are both working lower. We're experiencing considerably slower growth in money supply. And at the same time, the velocity of money is in a major downtrend. In 1997, $1 of new M2 growth increased GDP by $2.20. In the first quarter of this year, it was down to $1.42. This reflects the fact that we have too much of the wrong type of debt. There are many other influences in velocity, but that's the critical factor. I think it's important to remember that the velocity of money is very volatile. The old secular low was reached at 1.2 in 1946, and that was the year in which we saw the daily, weekly, and monthly lows in the 30-year bond yield. Now, if debt is the key factor, not the only factor, but the key factor which is driving the velocity of money downward, then velocity is going lower because in Europe, which is has a debt-to-GDP ratio 100 percentage points higher than the U.S. Velocity is at 1. And in China and in Japan, which are also more indebted than in the United States, Velocity is around 0.5 to 0.6. And we're on a path toward higher indebtedness. And as long as that path continues, the velocity of money will continue to drop. Monetary policy will be ineffective, and it will bring nominal growth down and the inflation rate down and move us toward the ultimate secular low in rates. So rates can go up for any one of a number of reasons, as they have done on 10 occasions since 1990, but the economy is too over-indebted for the rates to rise and stay up.
I know that you are a big fan, as I am, of Hyman Minsky. We were just talking to Professor Steve Keen last week about Minsky's work. But I know in a recent interview you did for Real Vision, you contrasted Minsky's work with Kindleberger. And I was not as familiar with Kindleberger. So please tell us about Kindleberger, and specifically, what did his work predict based on this huge amount of debt that we have? And I would refer our listeners specifically to the charts in pages 9, 11, and 14 of your chart book, where you're looking at various different forms of debt as a percentage of GDP.
Well, as it happens, I had an acquaintance with both Minsky and Kindleberger. I heard Minsky in the early 70s when I was in the Fed. I presented at the same session at the Kennedy Foundation Symposium on Reaganomics and Inflation, Stagflation, in the early 1980s. Minsky and I were on the same panel, and I heard the financial instability hypothesis. As it happened, Kindleberger was in the audience, and I had an opportunity to chat with him at length after my paper. My feeling is that Kindleberger is the deeper, broader thinker. His work, which is contained in several different places, but most notably in his book, Manias, Panics, and Crashes, which has been sustained after his life by his colleagues at MIT, is really an outstanding guidepost to understanding debt. And Kindleberger felt that extreme over-indebtedness has a threefold impact on markets. As the debt becomes excessive, it leads to overtrading. Now, overtrading is an old-timey term. It's in the Wealth of Nations, and it means that the debt accumulation pushes asset prices, whether it's real estate or commodities or stocks, to levels that are well beyond what is supported by the underlying fundamentals. This process, as Kindleberger makes clear, can go on for a long period of time. Eventually, it leads to a phase called discredit. That's also an old-timey term found in the Adam Smith Wealth of Nations. And he chooses that term very wisely because in discredit, a very few select investors see the imbalances in overtrading, the disparity between prices and underlying fundamental value. And they sell the assets and they pay off their loans, hence the term discredit. And the final phase is what Kindleberger called revulsion, another old-timey term, and he used a metaphor of a large group of people crowded into a small room with one exit, and they all smell the smoke at the same time. And I think that Kindleberger's view is more comprehensive. They are an alike in the sense that both of them are following in the tradition of Irving Fisher and others, who felt that the Great Depression and a number of other similar circumstances had been caused by extreme over-indebtedness. By the way, that view, which has been out there for a long time, has generally been ignored by the mainstream. Ben Bernanke, in his book, Essays in the Great Depression, acknowledges the views of Fisher, Minsky, and Kindleberger, and he says that to accept them, one would have to be willing to accept the proposition that people would do foolish things, in other words, become excessively over-indebted. And Bernanke goes on to say, as for me, I will push the rational model as far as it will go. In other words, he rejects them not because the data is flawed, the argument is flawed, but simply because it implies irrational behavior. As someone who's been in the financial markets for a long time, that's not a problem for me.
Yeah, we certainly have plenty of irrational behavior. So essentially, the picture here is too much total debt on every level, whether it be sovereign debt, corporate debt, household debt. And, you know, a lot of people have commented on this, saying that we're in uncharted waters. But I look at this chart that you've got on page 15 of your chart book. To me, it tells a very different story. I don't think we're in uncharted waters. I think we're sailing straight into 1990s Japan. And if you look at world GDP on page 17, that chart looks pretty scary as well. So is it true that where we are is basically where Japan was in the 90s? And does that mean that we're looking at decades of economic stagnation across the entire Western developed world the way Japan has seen in the last couple of decades?
I think that our results will mirror Japan over time, certainly not on a quarter-to-quarter or annual basis, but they are... Their public and private debt is just under 600% of GDP. Our total public and private debt is about 373%. They've tried to solve an indebtedness problem by taking on more debt. There are many, many examples of what has happened to extremely over-indebted economies. For example, I included a broad bibliography of very modern studies, including an important 2012 paper, peer-reviewed, was written by Carmen Reinhardt and Ken Rogoff, joined with Vincent Reinhardt. Outstanding study. There's been important recent work by Alan Taylor, also by a number of people in Europe. There is also work that's been done historically. For example, the leader of the Enlightenment, David Hume, his famous paper on public finance, written in 1752, reaches the conclusion that when a state has mortgaged all of its future liabilities, the state by necessity lapses into tranquility, languor, and impotence. And there was Irving Fisher's 1933 paper on the consequences of extreme over-indebtedness, including pointing out that one of the factors that will happen will be that velocity of money will be very weak. And so there has been a tremendous amount of work. It's just, generally speaking, been ignored. One excellent summary was published in 2010 by McKinsey Global Institute. They looked at 24 advanced economies, became extremely over-indebted. The indebtedness brought on a panic year, such as 1929, 1873, 2008, and they followed the process through to completion. It's a very long process, and what it shows is that an indebtedness problem cannot be solved by taking on additional debt. McKinsey says specifically that a multi-year sustained rise in the savings rate, what they term austerity, is needed to solve the problem, and of course, as we all know, in modern democracy, that option doesn't seem to exist. So we try to continuing to use what has failed. And while we get transitory improvement in economic activity, the longer term trend is to weaker and weaker economic performance.
Another factor that fascinates me, and I know that people watching Japan saw this decades ahead of time, but nobody really took it seriously, was the impact of demographics on their economy. And of course, we're later in our cycle, but as you show very nicely on page 21 of your chart book, we've had very low fertility rates on a relative basis persisting in the United States really since the 1970s. So how much lag time is there between the birth rates and when there is an economic effect felt? And does that effect come in waves? Is it all at once? How does this demographic function that we see on page 21 come to affect the real economy?
I think the better graph is page 20, which compares the population growth in the U.S. and Japan. And what is forgotten is that four decades ago, population growth in Japan was stronger than the United States. And people were writing articles and books under the general topic Rising Sun Economics. From that advantage in population growth of several tenths of a percentage point in the 70s, Japan's population is now declining. Our growth is still positive, but it was only 0.7% last year, which was the slowest growth since 1936. 37. In addition, we have a baby bust and we have a household formation bust. And what's basically happening is that there are certain social changes. Population is always a function of views, beliefs, social mores, and so forth. But our economy is increasingly underperforming. This is shown in page number 22, which is a graph of 10-year moving average of the growth rates in real disposable personal income. Historically, we've grown at 2.1%, currently growing at only 1% over the last 10 years. It's been remaining very depressed now for almost 7 years. And the longer that this persists, it conditions some of these population variables, not the only factor at work. And then the population or the demographic factors become weaker, and then that feeds back into the downward spiral in the growth rate. The chart on page 22 is very interesting because it helps to confirm some of the recent academic research, which shows that when economies become extremely over-indebted, and we've passed those thresholds for some time now, the economy loses about a third of its growth trend. In other words, if the growth trend was 3, we'd drop down to 2. But as chart 22 indicates, we're currently growing at 1/2 of our trend, which is also supported by some of the academic research that indicates as debt begins to move to extremely high levels, the relationship between debt and growth is nonlinear. And right now, it looks like that we're losing about 1/2 of our growth against trend, which is a very negative factor. And it's consistent with the fact that the velocity of money is declining, productivity growth is deteriorating, population growth is, and the other demographic factors are worsening. This is a downward spiral. It's not going to be reversed unless we deal with the indebtedness problem, and there's no effort to do so.
If I assimilate the views that you've shared with us so far, you're basically saying that we've got too much debt that is preventing the economy from growing. That means that we cannot afford higher treasury yields. We have to be in a low interest rate environment because the economy could not afford to service its debt at higher interest rates, and the demographics are not going to help us get out of this pickle. And to me, this brings a paradox into view, which is, you know, if we pretend that the U.S. Treasury debt was, I don't know, $400 quadrillion instead of $20 trillion, obviously that paper would be worthless because it would be impossible for the government to ever repay it. So it seems like what we're saying is the reason rates have to stay low and therefore the value of Treasury bonds has to increase is because we're moving closer to the point where they eventually become worthless because they're unserviceable. And of course, they could always be serviced in nominal terms, but in terms of real purchasing power, I would contend that we may already be at the point where this debt cannot be paid back without inflating away its value. So am I correct to see that as a paradox? And how does that eventually get resolved?
Of this debt, and if you include the debt that we have extended to the foreign sector and the banks, and there's some reason to at least be aware of those sums because a lot of the bank lending is to foreign entities and economies that are extremely over indebted. But I would say that there's approximately $20 trillion of debt that will mature in the next 2 years. A lot of debt is keyed to LIBOR or other floating rates. The bank's lending is, of course, relatively short term. And these debt figures do not include the leases. They should, and they will have to include them beginning in 2018. So we have roughly $20 trillion of debt that will mature in 2 years. Since the low point last year, the rates are up about 100 basis points across the curve. So 100 basis points times $20 trillion of short-term debt, that means the annual interest expense in 2 years will rise $200 billion. But last year, nominal GDP growth was only $530 billion. In other words, it's a massive drain. And that will remain the problem for the present and for a number of years, maybe decades to come. That's been the problem in Japan and Europe. They've had improvements in economic activity due to a variety of transitory factors. The markets think that this is the long-awaited cyclical upturn. The rates rise, the interest expense rises very dramatically, and then that truncates the recovery. Now, at the end of the day, when we reach a point of impasse, economists call that the bang point. And the bang point would be signaled by a tremendous flight into real assets. You would see the commodity prices surging, the value of the dollar declining. I don't believe that that day is at hand because global demand growth is too weak, especially nominal GDP growth in the U.S. In addition, the U.S. economy is not as indebted as its major trading partners. European debt is significantly greater. Japan is even worse shape. And so on a long-term basis, in terms of debt comparison, the U.S. has the cleanest dirty shirt. And so that serves to retain an underlying value of the dollar. We'd have to see a reversal in those conditions, which means that that the bang point is not at hand.
To my astonishment, it seems that Janet Yellen's inclination for dealing with all of this is to take us to negative interest rates. And of course, Europe has already been there. So I have several questions for you about negative interest rates, but I want to start with just the mechanics of this because I feel like I'm missing something. I've heard quite a few experts, including yourself, say, you know, it would be very difficult to engineer negative interest rates in the U.S. Treasury market. And I feel like I'm missing something because we've had zero coupon treasury bonds for a long time. It seems to me you sell a zero coupon bond for a premium above par and you've got a negative yielding instrument. What am I missing here?
Well, those, though, have an effective market yield. In fact, the yield of maturity there on the zero coupon bonds are higher than on the coupon bonds. You just don't receive payment every year. And so for long-term investors such as us here at Hoisington Management, we're interested in the total rate of return. And so that's not a problem. But here is the difficulty. Right now, of course, Mrs. Yellen is raising rates. And in the process of raising rates, they're contracting the monetary base. They're slowing the rate of growth in M2. They're slowing the rate of growth in bank lending. They're causing a contraction in the credit aggregates. In other words, they're taking steps to slow the economy right now, which means that economic performance will be even worse. In other words, the debt fundamentals are being reinforced by a very restrictive monetary policy. And, of course, the slowdown in the reserve monetary and credit aggregates is occurring alongside a continuing very sharp drop in the velocity of money. So if the Fed, let's say, theoretically, were to want to go to negative interest rates and they needed to hold them there for any length of period of time, what they would have to do is they would have to call the currency in. And in fact, there have been a number of proposals from academicians who can see this as a potentiality. In fact, there have been some modest steps toward that. Europe has eliminated the 500-euro note. So if you were to, for example, go to negative interest rates, the firms that have big campuses and security and so forth, instead of holding short-term paper that's with a negative yield, they'll hold currency. And eventually in time, although it's very cumbersome to do so, individuals would hold currency. And so to make the policy workable for more than just a limited period of time, you'd have to call in the currency. And that, of course, would require a lot of changes, legislative changes in the United States. I don't know about elsewhere in the world, but I don't think it would be well received. And in the final analysis, it would be very, very harmful because for all economies and all times, investment in plant and equipment, physical investment, must equal saving out of income. And if you do not provide people an incentive to save, then there will not be sufficient funds to invest in plant and equipment. Growth will become even weaker, and the standard of living will fall more rapidly. The demographics will deteriorate. So it would be, in my view, a very unfortunate pathway to go down. There would be serious problems for the money market mutual funds, for a lot of the smaller community banks and credit unions and so forth. But even in time, negative interest rates would undermine the financial intermediary process and would be very difficult for the big banks and the insurance companies. It's not a palpable long-term solution, in my view.
I couldn't agree more with that. And it seems to me that the unintended consequence of sustained negative rates, I mean, it effectively undermines the whole model of providing an incentive to save and invest. And I think that the most important social contract that we have in society is pensions. We tell the people who actually work hard for a living, look, you got to trust us that smart finance guys like us are overseeing this system that's going to protect your financial security and your retirement. And if we have negative interest rates, I mean, am I missing something or is it impossible to avoid a pension crisis?
You got it exactly right. And I would add this. I think that quantitative easing has had serious unintended consequences. When quantitative easing was unveiled, the Fed said that one of the objectives was to support higher stock prices in the hope that this would create a wealth effect which would boost consumer spending. Well, the wealth effect never materialized. It never has materialized. It's a theoretical concept. It's not supported by the empirical facts. Too few people own enough stocks to really change their consumption behavior. But when the Fed said they wanted a high stock market, that was a signal to the corporate managers that financial investments are preferred to real investments. And so what has been happening as a result of the unintended consequence of quantitative easing is that firms have engaged in financial engineering, buying back their shares, buying the shares of others, paying higher dividends with debt that they've acquired rather than investing in plant and equipment. Last year was a classic example of that. Business debt rose to a record percentage of GDP, higher than ever in any time in the past, including the 08 and 09 peaks. Business debt was up $700+ billion, and investment in plant equipment inventories actually declined $21 billion. That's the problem with theories of grand design. Theories of grand design, it's impossible to anticipate the unintended consequences. It's better when change is needed to make marginal adjustments so that if you have to reverse them because of these poor results, you're able to do so.
Several people have suggested that the solution to all of this is a so-called debt jubilee, where the government either prints a whole bunch of money, whether it be Treasury money or Fed money, that is used to pay down either national debt or, in some models that have been suggested, there's a massive handout of printed money to the general populace with a requirement that they have to use it to pay down debt. Are these things realistic, or are they just the pipe dreams of the over-indebted?
No, those programs are not really realistic, and moreover, they would require massive law changes. Let's say the Treasury started printing currency. Well, what would that paper be? Would it be an asset or a liability? Well, it's a liability of the Treasury. It would be a zero maturity liability of the U.S. Treasury. Well, to issue that obligation, the debt statute laws would have to be rewritten. That, I think it would be very difficult to do that, because it is a liability. In addition, the Federal Reserve could not fund that on an unmatched basis, because the Federal Reserve Act requires that the assets of the Federal Reserve equal the liabilities. So to go along that path, you would then need to rewrite the debt statute laws, you would need to rewrite the Federal Reserve Act, and then after you did that, the country would be a banana republic, and if we got into an inflationary situation, we would never be able to control it. I hope we wouldn't go down that path, but conceivably, you could pass the legislation and do it. I would think it would be a very sad day for the country if we did that, though.
So how do you see this ending then? The problem is too much debt on every level. A debt jubilee is not going to solve it. The demographics are not going to solve the problem. They're going to make it worse. How does all of this end? Japan, a lot of people talked about the lost decade. Then it became two lost decades. I'm not sure if we're pushing three lost decades the way things are looking. How does this ever end?
Well, we could get lucky. Something of a great magnitude. In essence, this is what happened in the past in a couple of instances. In the 1820s and 1830s, we took on a lot of debt to finance the early canals, steamship lines, railroads. There was overinvestment, overconsumption. The panic year was 1838. Martin Van Buren was president. He didn't know what was going on. He was hit by this. The country languished very badly for 11 years, and then gold was discovered in California, led to a huge surge in national income. People very careful how they spent their income. We paid off the debt of the 1820s, 1830s, and the economy recovered. In 1873, we had another panic year brought on by too much debt, debt to finance the railroads. Remember, we built the Central Line first, and then the Northern and Southern routes, a lot of feeder road industries that supplied the railroads overexpanded. It was overinvestment, overconsumption. The panic year hit. Grant was no more knowledgeable of what was going on than Van Buren had been in 1838. We had no central bank. The government continued to balance its budget. We had a prolonged period of austerity, but by the early 1890s, the problem had been solved, and we began to go on our merry way. Now, if you use that example of doing nothing, Kendallberger called it letting it burn itself out. And just let's say Japan had followed the let it burn itself out rule starting from 1989. They would be out of their problem. But they tried to solve the indebtedness problem going to ever higher levels of debt, and they're still in the quagmire today. In World War II, we were in very dire circumstances. We really had only the most marginal of recoveries from the Great Depression. Unemployment rate was still in its mid-teens. We entered World War II. The bond yield was about 2%, which was reflective of how poor business conditions were. But as we entered World War II, there was a dramatic surge in our exports. We took over markets of our allies. They couldn't supply them. We also supplied our allies with war materials and other items. We had mandatory rationing. The saving rate went up to 25, 26, 28%, and we paid down the debt of the 1920s and 1930s. We had the great post-war boom because we had a clean balance sheet, which those three instances that I gave you, the 1838, 1873, 1929, illustrate the validity of McKinsey's finding. You solve an indebtedness problem by austerity. McKinsey defines austerity as a significant, sustained, multi-year rise in the saving rate. And that does not appear to be likely for the stage of our modern democracy. So we just have transitory spouts in economic activity that don't last very long, and we basically grind lower. And that's really essentially the finding that Hume came to the conclusion. Remember that Hume was one of the greatest minds of mankind. Without him, the Enlightenment would not have been possible. And so we're basically on that path unless we have the will to deal with it. And apparently we do not. Take one of the problems that we have. Government debt right now is approaching 107% of GDP. Without any new initiatives from the current administration, current Congress, federal debt is going to be up to around 125% in the next 2 decades, more or less, because of promises that have been made under Social Security, Medicare, and the Affordable Care Act. And so we're moving the debt levels higher, whether we want to or not. So if we're going to try the same result, try the same policy path, we're going to get more of the same result.
And of course, Reinhardt and Rogoff's work tells us that 100% debt to GDP tends to be a tipping point, after which it's very difficult to return.
Actually, their most recent study, and the one with the greatest amount of detail and documentation, finds that when government debt exceeds 90% for 5 consecutive years, you lose about a third of your growth rate. And we did that in 2012. 2016, government debt exceeded 100% for 5 consecutive years. And we're now moving higher. There was an outstanding study published by the European Central Bank by Rother and Cecerita. Dr. Rother is head of the fiscal affairs department of the European Central Bank. They found that when government debt rises into these high levels, the negative relationship between debt and economic growth becomes nonlinear. In other words, the depressing effect of the debt becomes even greater at higher levels of debt. And I'm afraid that we're seeing evidence of that. And in fact, I mentioned that earlier when we were discussing the trend in real disposable personal income on a per capita basis.
So your prescriptions for what the solution should be would be to stop trying to solve a problem of too much debt with more debt and to increase savings rates. We're not doing either of those things, and government policy is quite officially, essentially, increasing debt, trying to encourage more borrowing and lending because they think that's what's going to stimulate the economy. So we're doing exactly the wrong thing, and we're doing more of it at a time when we're already too far down this road. What do you see this resulting in? Are we looking at decades of economic stagnation, as Japan has seen for the last 20 years? How long can it go on, and how do you see the story playing out, let's say, over the next 20 years for the United States and the rest of the West?
I think that we're on a path toward gradually weaker economic growth. There'll be spurts, transitory periods of economic activity. Our hopes will be raised. We'll not be able to proceed at our traditional rates of economic growth. Our demographics will deteriorate, standard of living will deteriorate, which they're already doing, unless we collectively can address the indebtedness problem. And quite frankly, there seems to be no interest in doing so.
Now, the U.S. dollar remains the world's reserve currency, and I would argue that's because there simply is no alternative to the U.S. Treasury market in terms of a deep and liquid enough bond market to absorb central bank-sized capital flows. There are a growing number of people around the world, particularly Sergei Glazyev, an economic advisor to Vladimir Putin, and his whole de-dollarization campaign, where he basically asserts that Russia should try to get rid of the U.S. dollar and encourage as many countries as possible to dump the dollar in favor of something, maybe another system that is not so indebted. Do you think that there's any realistic viability to that leading anywhere, or is that just propaganda?
Well, the real problem is that, based on my numbers, if we use total public and private debt, including the debt owed to us by the foreign sector and the debt of our financial institutions, using that comparison globally, our debt figure is about 373% of GDP, and the figure is about 470% in Europe and about 590% in Japan. It's about 390% in China. And I don't know the number for Russia, but I think they're far more indebted than we are. So there's no economic area that is less indebted than we are. Germany has good numbers individually, but of course they are part of the European currency zone, which is significantly more indebted than we are. So there's just no real viable alternative at the present time. Maybe in due course one will emerge, but it's not at hand.
Well, thank you for what has certainly been a very sobering interview. We didn't get time to get to all of your charts in this excellent chart book. Our registered users have the link in their Research Roundup email to download the chart book. I know that these charts came from your quarterly reports, where there's quite a bit more accompanying commentary that explains the charts we didn't get to. Would it be possible for our listeners who want to read more of your work to get a copy of those reports? And if so, how can they do so?
Yes, we make our quarterly letters available as a public service. And if you go on our website, www.hoisingtonmgt.com, send us your contact information, we'll be glad to add you to the quarterly distribution list.
Hoisington has over $3 billion in assets under management. The flagship retail product is the Wasatch Hoisington U.S. Treasury Fund. That is a no-load mutual fund that's available to all investors. For our institutional audience, you also act as a fixed income investment advisor to pensions, insurance companies, and so forth. And so for our institutional audience, if you'd like to find out more about Dr. Hunt's advisory services, you can contact Hoisington through their website. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Dr. Lisi Hunt. You know, I absolutely love the fact that he is so strong in his conviction that the secular lows of interest rates are not in. We have so many people flip-flopping on this, and it was so fashionable earlier in the year in the reflation trade to be calling an end to that secular bond bull market. But really, Lacey has made it very clear that this big picture trend is not over. What are your views on the interview?
Well, I think that it's fascinating to me that, you know, you look at Lacey Hunt, you look at Steve Keen, two very prominent and well-respected economists that have very, very different views. But the common thread is they both see that we are in a situation that has no clean exit. There is no prescription for do such and such, and that will solve it. We have a problem that's created by too much debt. And the solution that governments are responding with is more debt. And just as it's true that one of the ways you can treat a heroin addict is to give him more heroin because it'll make him feel better, you know, that doesn't solve the problem. And I think we've gotten ourselves into a point of no return where Western governments are basically over-indebted. We've gone way too far, spending beyond our means on borrowed money. And now that debt has accumulated to the point where there is no clean exit. And as he says, that leaves us in this situation where we're maybe turning Japanese, as Professor Steve Keen said last week, where we're going to be looking at potentially decades of economic stagnation because of the overburdened economy. And it's fascinating to me that two very different economists with very different views basically come to the same endpoint conclusion.
Now, Eric, during the interview, you actually brought up the question talking about the debt paradox, and I wanted to elaborate on that. Why don't you just once again touch on that, and let's have a conversation about it.
Sure. Well, you know, this is, to me, the most fascinating intellectual thought exercise of our lifetimes, really, because it is so important to the future of Western society. It really is that big of a deal. And I think that Dr. Hunt's views so perfectly illustrate this, because if you listen to what he says, he's absolutely right. It makes perfect sense, his logic, that with this deceleration in the velocity of money and this massive accumulation of debt, the economy cannot afford higher interest rates. We're stuck, as Japan has been for decades, with very, very low interest rates and economic stagnation because of over-indebtedness. Makes perfect logical sense. But if you really step back to the big picture and think about what that statement really means, remembering that there's an inverse relationship between interest rates and the value of the bonds, what we're saying is the value, the price of those treasury bonds, has to continue to go up over time. Why does it have to continue to go up over time? Because we're getting closer and closer as we accumulate more and more debt to getting to the point where eventually we realize, hey, this is a completely unserviceable situation. Just as, you know, you can continue if you're a young person who gets too many credit cards and is spending beyond their means, they can keep the party going for quite a while. Eventually, it all blows up when they realize there's just no way out. They've borrowed so much, it's impossible for them to ever service their debt, and they go bankrupt. And all of a sudden, those bonds, in the analogy, the treasury bonds would become worthless because they're unserviceable. So the paradox that I see here, Patrick, is the reason, and I agree completely with Dr. Hunt, that the value of treasury bonds has to continue to increase is because we're getting closer and closer to the point of realizing that they're worthless. Now, that's crazy. But, you know, we're going to continue to put more and more faith into this system. We're going to get lower and lower treasury yields. Eventually, we'll get negative treasury yields. And at some point, as the value of these things gets higher and higher, someday we're going to wake up and realize something, which I think we've already crossed the point. I argue that it is already true today that the U.S. Treasury debt of $20 trillion, it's mathematically impossible for that ever to be repaid in real terms. Of course, you can repay it in nominal terms because you just print more money and pay it back. But if you realize, if the person who's buying the bonds realizes, wait a minute, it's guaranteed that the only way they can ever pay me back if I make this loan to the government is to inflate away the purchasing value of those dollars so I get paid back with money that's not worth what I paid in. I lose no matter what in real terms. As soon as people someday wake up and recognize that that is the case, all of a sudden, that's what triggers a collapse of confidence in the entire treasury system. We're not there yet, but it has to come someday.
Well, you know, Eric, when you look at the idea of this debt super cycle, I know Ray Dalio and others have always touched on it. One of the characteristics of being so late in that debt super cycle is the intervention by central banks with all these unconventional monetary policies. Like, it's no longer that they'll just have to adjust short-term interest rates higher or lower. But now we see everything from quantitative easing to yield curve control to eventually we may see helicopter money becoming prominent within it. And that's because the central banks have to intervene and they need to push these bond prices higher and higher to get those interest rates lower and lower. So it's almost an orchestrated event. I don't think investors would just keep trading these bonds in that paradox higher and higher because they want more and more of them. I think it literally has to be manipulated or massaged higher by the central banks.
Well, that's exactly right, Patrick. And the question is, at what point do you see a wholesale loss of confidence in the central bankers? So far, we're seeing a very strong, you know, the system is holding up. The Fed owns some ridiculous percentage of the 30-year Treasury issuance. But, you know, nobody blinks over that. At some point, you get to the point where you're saying, wait a minute, the government is borrowing money from itself and buying bonds from itself in order to prop up the value of the bonds from itself. This is all a big house of cards. And exactly as Dr. Lacey Hunt said in today's interview, what eventually happens is there is a collapse of confidence in central bankers, and there is a flight from paper assets into real assets, into precious metals, into real estate, into physical, tangible things. We're not there yet. If there's one place that I disagree with the diehard gold bug community, it's their predictions that this is imminently about to happen just, you know, next week or something. They've been saying that for 30 years. It hasn't happened. It is going to happen someday. We're going to have a wholesale loss of confidence. There will be a U.S. Treasury bond crisis, and there will be a flight capital going out of treasuries into hard assets. When that happens, it is economic Armageddon. I don't predict it as something that's going to happen this year or next year or even in the next 10 years, probably. But someday, you know, we cannot continue forever to just borrow and spend beyond our means and count on central banks to click on a print button and save the day.
You know,
someday this all falls apart.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, Eric, I couldn't agree more. See, I always kind of explain it, and I look at it from this perspective that who really has a vested interest in seeing the end game? You know, the governments don't, the bankers don't, and certainly citizens don't. And so if no one has a vested interest in watching it fail, it's so easy to kick the can down the road, to keep pushing. This is why a Japan-style scenario is far more likely. And all of the gold bugs that are genuinely scared that it's all going to happen, you know, are planning like it's going to occur right now. It's not likely. It's more than likely that we're going to continue to accept worse and worse conditions, but kick the can down the road farther and farther to just keep the system going.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And I think we are headed towards negative interest rates before this is over. As Dr. Hunt said, right now we're in a tightening cycle where we're increasing interest rates. Eventually, we'll, you know, this economic cycle is already long in the tooth. We'll get to the point where there's a recession. The Fed needs to be more accommodative, and we'll eventually get to negative interest rates. There's one place that I do disagree with Dr. Hunt and almost everybody else I've heard comment on this. What he said today is, well, you can have slightly negative interest rates, but you can't have big negative interest rates because big negative interest rates create an incentive for cash hoarding where people would simply take their cash out of the bank and put it in a safe someplace rather than buy treasuries because that way, you know, your rate of return of zero is better than the negative rate of return on treasuries. Now, before we had negative interest rates, the same people were saying you couldn't have negative interest rates for this reason. Now what they're saying is, well, you can have for a limited period of time, slightly negative interest rates. I think we're playing with fire here. I think central bankers are playing with fire. I think a true statement is that as soon as you have any negative interest rates, there's a financial incentive for people to take money out of the fractional reserve banking system and just hold cash in a mattress or a vault someplace. Right now, that financial incentive is a small financial incentive because we don't have very negative interest rates. We only have slightly negative interest rates in Europe and slightly positive interest rates in the United States. When this persists, it's not about a certain rate or a certain time. It's when the panic starts. When people see, wait a minute, this whole thing is crazy. It makes much more sense for me to just cash in my assets in physical dollar bill cash and put it in a vault or a safe someplace. When people start to do that, that is the run on the bank on the entire fractional reserve banking system. And it could completely bankrupt the system. We can't let that happen. Now, I think that central bankers are playing with fire by letting European interest rates go negative. They kind of rationalized. They said, well, in theory, it creates that incentive for people to hoard cash, but you know, they're not going to do it, not for just a few basis points. It's when they do start doing it, and other people, just like any other bank run, when other people start following suit and there's copycats, that's when the whole thing just spirals out of control. So they haven't outlawed cash yet. They don't have the systems in place to outlaw cash, but they're going ahead and experimenting with negative interest rates, even when it is creating this incentive. They're playing with fire, Patrick. It's dangerous.
Well, you know, I think that this is why we continue to see almost all the governments in the world moving towards a cashless society. If they can remove the physical currency out of circulation and keep it all as electronic digits, then you can't really have a run on the banks in the traditional sense. And maybe that's why we're seeing such a strong movement to that. But Eric, what I wanted to do is move on to just kind of looking at this as how does one trade this? How does one position themselves in the markets with all of this? No, because these are just such big picture concepts, right? Now, if Dr. Lacey Hunt is right, and when the secular lows of interest rates are not yet in, there's another big bond rally coming. And while we've already seen a lot of the short interest in that reflation trade story been fully unwound, we still haven't seen anyone piling long treasuries here to play this Lacey Hunt narrative. So you have this conflicting view. For instance, Solon Conference Gunlatch pretty much almost doubled down on his calls on interest rates, almost mocking people that were going long 10-year yields at the 2.17 range. And so you have these very smart people like Gunlatch almost anticipating still a little bit higher interest rates. But then you have the big picture view from Lacey, which is looking at this idea that interest rates are actually going much, much lower. So when is the moment when you buy? When do you take those long trades in the treasuries? And this is where we want to explore how to trade that. What's your view on this?
Well, you know, certainly Juliet DeClercq gets credit. She had just made her call to buy treasuries at 2.60 yield. That was within about 3 or 4 basis points of being the high yield. So we missed that one. You know, we're back up here at 2.38 as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. I don't know that it's necessarily time to pile in here. I would imagine for someone like yourself who has the knowledge and background in options trading that, you know, options are probably one attractive way to play this. But I think we have to consider that it really depends on the investor's time horizon and their background. A retail investor who has a very long time horizon and just wants to sort of, you know, think about safety trade here. Well, if you don't have any gold yet, probably buy some of that. Be ready for it to go down below 1,000 before this is over if the commodity deflation wave that we see coming plays out. But have some just in case, because in the end game, you're going to want to have gold. I think we're a long way from that end game. What are your thoughts?
To go back to that idea of using options, I absolutely love it. I mean, the way we kind of look at it is that there's a legitimate chance that the lows we saw for over the last couple of months may have been the lowest levels we've seen in bonds or the highest yields that we're going to see this year. But there's also a chance we haven't. There's a, you know, Gunlatch suggested we might see 3% on the 10-year. There's always a chance. And so how do you put yourself in a position to accumulate the bonds, but do it in a risk-managed way? And this is where I absolutely love the idea of just buying call options on treasury here, because it pays a positive yield. That yield is actually discounted into the options, which actually makes the calls even cheaper by discounting that in there. And you can use the calls as a way to exercise and accumulate treasury positions. But at the same time, if you're wrong or early, then you're not locked in for the purchase. And if you have, it's sort of like a mulligan in golf. You're getting a second shot at a different entry point if you're early on that one. So I'm kind of dabbling here with treasuries using call options, and we're going to see whether it works. And if it doesn't, I'll take some losses on the calls, but I'll have another shot later in the year to probably buy even better prices. But I wanted to touch on your idea of gold. And while I agree with you, buying gold in the long term is actually probably a great idea. You know, I kind of look at it very similarly to Jeffrey Christian, which we had on a month ago or so on the show. And his view was that there's like a secular gold bull coming out with highs coming to 2020. I sort of have that same view, but I think that short-term timing is going to be really rough, because the period where I believe the really big gold rally is going to occur is going to be when we have the business cycle turn and we start seeing almost recessionary style and numbers coming out. And Janet Yellen will have to flip-flop monetary policy, where she'll have to stop raising and start cutting and then providing liquidity into the market through some QE program. And as soon as we see the central bank, or at least the market starts getting the hint that central banks will flip, will be when gold will have its day in the sun. And I think that that's still probably a year or more away. And so I think that gold was probably, I think bonds will actually bottom before gold does. And I think that looking for that gold trade is probably something at best late in this year, but even maybe a 2018 story.
You can argue this either way. Certainly, I am absolutely convinced that in the end game, whenever that is, you want to own gold for sure. Thing is, you can draw a long-term trend line from that high in 2011, the all-time high in gold, the next major high after that a couple of years later, and this high that we just had right around 1300. If you continue to follow that down line, you can come up with a 890 target for gold before this is over. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to happen. It just means it's one of the possibilities. So I think it really depends, again, on your time horizon. For someone who doesn't have time to think about markets all the time, having some gold in your portfolio is a real good idea, and someday it's going to be worth more than it is now. For people who have time and interest to follow markets closely, I think it's probably going to be worth less than it is now before it's worth more than it is now. And I'm going to keep an eye on it and look for a better opportunity. But unfortunately, we're going to need to leave it there for this week. We have another super rock star guest coming up for next week's show. Be sure to tune in. Don't miss that one, folks. And meanwhile, we need your help promoting the show. We really appreciate it when you retweet us on Twitter. Forward your research roundup emails to your friends and colleagues. The more registered users we have at macrovoices.com, the more able Patrick is to recruit these really high-end guests like Dr. Lacey Hunt and another really good one coming up next week. So please register your free account if you haven't already at macrovoices.com. It's free. We won't spam you. We won't sell your address or do anything else sleazy. And the benefit to you is you'll get our free research roundup email every week. It's just a compendium of links to all the cool free stuff we could find on the internet each week. Never any advertising or marketing, and it comes automatically when you sign up. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
In this week's research roundup, as always, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Lacey Hunt. As well, you'll find the chart book that you referenced earlier at the beginning of the session for so people can follow along in the interview. There's also a link to an article discussing the U.S. and North Korea game theory. I found it actually a great read. There's also a link to comments from Goldman Sachs about the last time correlations in the markets were this low was just before the financial crisis. As well, there's for those that didn't catch the interview, because I'm sure many have already seen it, there's the video interview on CNBC of Jeffrey Gunlatch and his comments on passive investing doesn't exist. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share the content with our listeners, please email us at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with that MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you have not already, you can follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric directly on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.